Hi, this is Paul. Wanted to do another video on Rhett and Link, and again, partly because they are such good illustrations that are YouTube accessible for something that's been going on for a long time. I just watched their latest video, Are We Scared of Hell? If you listen to some of their other videos where they talk about their rise on YouTube, they're pretty conscious of thumbnails and tags to get audience, and this one certainly would. In terms of sort of a clickbait title, they're really part of the what I'll call the Not Sure movement, and I'll tell you why I call it that in a minute. They do treat the subject of hell in their video, and I thought it was worth watching, and I've actually got some clips that I might play in a subsequent video about that, but as is so often the case, I was going to make a video yesterday, but pastoral things came up, and I didn't really have much of any chance during the day to do it, so here I am today, but the video changed pretty significantly overnight. Now, most of the question answers that they received were about deconstruction, and I thought, you know, it was all pretty much as I'd expect, having seen many people go through this over the years, and it very much reminded me of a book by, well, Rachel Held Evans, and by John Sook. Now, many more of you will know Rachel Evans than John Sook, but I'll talk about John Sook mostly during this video. Rachel Held Evans, of course, a girl who grew up in Dayton, Tennessee. Her father was a teacher in the Christian college there. A very sharp young woman, very clear thinker, good writer. I first came across Rachel Held Evans sort of before she hit the big time, probably on Twitter or some social media. And I remember seeing her describe herself as an author, speaker, something like this. And I thought, that seems sort of pretentious for such a young woman. But she very much pulled it off. And she very much hit that wave of doubt books, really, before the deconstruction language took on. Part of the reason I put the Decadence book here is I've just started reading Ross Douthat's book, The Decadent Society, and I'm really loving it. And so it'll creep into a lot of my videos. Those of you who have watched my videos know actually, it's not true that I fall in love with every book that I read. I'm usually reading four or five books at a time, and then one book will grab me, and I'll just double down on that book, much of how Dominion did. And so this book has really grabbed me, and I really am enjoying Douthat's analysis. But so before the Rhett and Link deconstruction, we had a lot of doubt books, and Rachel Held Evans, her first one that kind of launched her into the public limelight, Evolving in Monkey Town. It was eventually the title, and the cover were changed. I don't remember what they were changed to. I was at that point blogging for a thing on the internet called Think Christian, which is connected to my denomination. It used to be called Back to God Hour, now Reframe Media. And I talked about, I opened that review this way. Tim Keller offered his observation in the introduction of his book, Reason for God. Without a faith, without some doubts, is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she has failed over the years to listen patiently to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection. And then I wrote, Rachel Held Evans' first book, Evolving in Monkey Town, is about avoiding that collapse. Or perhaps looking back on her life now, she passed away not too long ago. You can decide for yourself whether she avoided the collapse or if she collapsed. And that's very much the situation with Rhett and Link in terms of people's take on them. Very much the same can be said of John Sook in his book, Not Sure. But again, this, because I've got the Decadent Society rolling through my head, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that in many ways, we're not doing fresh work anymore. We're retreading the kinds of things that have been done for a while, and sometimes to a lesser degree. So the summary of my review of her book goes like this. Rachel, I think, speaks for a generation within her subculture when she writes, doubt is the mechanism by which faith evolves. One of my favorite characters, one of my favorite chapters was the brief one where she describes her husband fixing up and flipping a house and repeatedly admonishing her to respect the process. And I think that's good admonition. I was reviewing some of Andrew Sweeney's blog posts about John Vervaeke's work and, you know, wisdom not just being true in terms of outcome, but also in terms of process. And so, you know, I think a lot of people jumping on Rhett and Link, I think it's important to respect the process, but it's also, as you'll see in this video, valid to critique the process. These are words of wisdom for an older generation of anxious parents worried about where and how their children will land. And that certainly isn't true, and it's certainly true of me too now as a parent of older children. My children are quite a bit older than they were when I wrote this piece, I think in 2010 or so. How will this book be used? I think it will bring comfort to a lot of young women who are haunted by what Rachel brings forward and won't feel as frightened or alone because of her book. Most of what I hear her pushing against, I've heard in the voices of many others like her, anxious church leaders that simply can't see why their formulas for generational compliance are falling short, might want to listen carefully to her story. Again, and do thoughts, I walked to church today. I sometimes walk to church so that my car isn't in the parking lot, so I have a little bit of time to do videos, and I don't have quite so many random visitors to the door. But Duthat talked about the fact that in many ways religious decadence has set in terms of stagnation, and that's I'm really interested in Duthat's book, and I'm gonna have to engage it in videos. I'm already doing it. The stuff just seeps up. Our projects and programs for inviting the next generation into the faith should never replace our faith in the one who calls them. Vital to this transference is the full and free appropriation of the faith, which is always a scary process. 20 years from now, and again, it's a tragedy that Rachel didn't see 20 years from now. 20 years from now, Rachel may be writing another book about her daughter's doubts, about Rachel's questions and answers. Central is our Lord's generational Central is our Lord's generational missionary enterprise. Should be central too. The editors didn't catch that. Neither did I. Central to our Lord's generational missionary enterprise is the kind of anxious questioning known to every praying Christian. Now, about the time Rachel's book came out, John Sook's book came out. John Sook was, in the Christian Reformed Church, someone who had reached the pinnacle of my profession. His book was published in 2011. I'm just looking over his... He was honorably released in 2012, so not too long after his book. And I know John personally, and I'll tweet out this video on Twitter, so John may very well watch it. John very much reached the CRC pastor's career pinnacle fairly early. He pastored local churches. Being editor of the Banner in past generations was in many ways the pinnacle of one's Christian Reformed career. The Banner, all the way up, I think, into the 70s, this sort of ended in the 80s and 90s, the banner was the kitchen table of the denomination. It was a weekly magazine, and it was the place that, in many ways, in the denomination, the discussions of the denomination were held. The Banner is now a monthly magazine that I don't know too many, none of the pastors in my cluster, to my knowledge, read it at all. And I don't read it at all. What does that say about the denomination? What is that? I could talk about the Christian Reformed Church a lot here, but I'm not going to. John was also a missionary to the Philippines doing theological education. And then he left the Christian Reformed Church. And when it says here in his CRC minister's database that he was, yes, you can look me up, and I didn't even wear a nice suit. I was that kind of a guy in seminary. But anyway, John was honorably released, which meant he wasn't under any kind of discipline, but he was released because he basically said to the Christian Reformed Church, I can no longer in good conscience subscribe to the doctrinal positions of the church. And he got a lot of criticism for that, especially having been a high-profile pastor, but I've always respected him for it. This is exactly how the system is supposed to work. Instead of Yeah, there's a lot of other games that people can play, and in my opinion, John didn't play those games. He acted honorably, and that's exactly the right word. And he joined the United Church of Canada and has, you know, he's regarded as many as a traitor, but he's remained a blogger. And in fact, just recently, I'll get to that blog pretty quickly. If his book were to be published today, we'd probably call it a deconstruction. Now, some of this stuff will have some CRC insider stuff in it, but a little quote from his book, Not Sure. Both Sietse Bunnings, I can't say it right because I don't have enough Dutch in me. That's a pen name for Stanley Wiersma, who was a Calvin College professor who wrote some delightful poetry about what it meant to be Christian Reformed in the 20th century. And quite well known in the denomination. Both Sietse Bunnings' community and mind shared ethnicity and the cohesive use of doctrine and mores to create stronger identification between the community's many members. The content of the doctrine isn't nearly as important as the fact that everyone in a position of authority, pastors, elders, deacons, sign a form of subscription in which they state agreement with the doctrines that, and then even promise to promote them, while laying out a very onerous, if not impossible, process for expressing disagreement with those doctrines. Thus, the body of doctrine functions as a means of identification and community solidarity rather than something that lives in the heart and cannot help but find expression on the lips. The truth is, most of the people who sign the form of subscription today could hardly detail what the doctrines are that they are agreeing with. And that's very true, and this has been I've shared these criticisms of our system. In many faith communities, doctrines, moralities, and ethnicity are used consciously and unconsciously to create identification within that community. Altogether, this identification is thought of as the faith, I would say. However, that a feature of healthy faith is one that is able to empty herself or himself of too great an attachment to any of this, to any aspect in this Trinity, not the Trinity, in this Trinity, while keeping greater attachment to the core teachings of Jesus about love, including love in community. John's book is a wonderful book. I read his book and appreciated it, even though it was pretty clear from the outset where he was going with this book. John tells his own story in this book. He had a PhD in communication. This book is both moving and challenging, although, again, I don't think that anybody at this point who've paid much of attention to it will find anything terribly surprising in the book. He articulates well many of the challenges that have brought people to and what is popularly called deconstruction today. So I'll leave a link to the book in the notes. And so I've, with quite a bit of fascinated, continue to read John's blog. He's got a blog entitled Not Sure, and he writes on it fairly regularly because, for me, I've always wondered. I don't share, I've got my own doubts, and I talk about my own doubts and my own thoughts very freely on this YouTube channel. But I definitely have wondered, you know, what does he have to say to this world of fear and pain that we have today? Because someone comes up to you and says, you know, Pastor, what about this? And, well, I'm not sure. Now, part of that might sound refreshing if you're coming out of a community of hidebound dogma that always had plastic answers to basic questions. But if you're not pastoring in a community like that, people are looking for something. And, you know, kind of sort of throwing out all of your anxious anxieties and not sure of this and not sure of that, I've never found that to be terribly helpful to people either in overseas ministry or ministry in North America. And so I've been fascinated to read the sermons that he posts on his blog, and he just did a thing on the COVID virus on his blog and mortality, very much asking the same question that the nuns a la, you know, Nathan Jacobs and Rhett and Link ask, you know, what happens after you die? This question doesn't go away. And I don't find not sure to be a very helpful answer. So actually, last night when I went to bed, I sort of reminiscent of Jordan Peterson not being able to sleep and gets up and does a screed. I didn't get up and do a screed because with the volume of my natural speaking voice, I would wake everyone up in the house, much to the annoyance of my wife and my daughter. I wrote a whole bunch of stuff in a Google Doc that I'm sort of going to read through as I go through this. I didn't make slides for them, but we'll see how this goes. I'm always tinkering with my process. And I think Rhett and Link's not sureness is really sort of a humble brag, and I'll get to why that is. And you know, the primary message that you'll hear from their question and answer video and from their other videos is, I'm not sure. I'm an agnostic. Not only do I have doubts, but I wear my doubts on the outside, not on the inside. Now, that's not nothing. And it's also another form of, I would say, religious expression. Expressive individualism. Again, De Thought in his book mentions that, you know, from the time that Robert Bella wrote Habits of the Heart, which I read in seminary in the 1980s, the stuff hasn't really changed that much. And that says something, that in some ways society feels stalled. And sort of what I think about is that scene in The Matrix where, you know, the 1990s was the epitome of our society, and it's sort of like, well, we're in a simulation and we're sort of stuck there. The calendar keeps ticking, but as Du Thought and others noted, you know, some things just haven't really changed that much. And then this very much mirrors, you know, John Sook and what he expressed in his book. Here again, he even wrote a book, Not Sure. He was the pinnacle. He came from a good Canadian family and writes about the, you know, the faith of his father and his grandparents. They were Dutch immigrants. The Canadian immigration story is post-World War II, unlike the immigration story that brought my grandparents, great-grandparents to the United States at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. Now, here's the thing. I don't fully buy the not sure thing, because it seems to quite often have a lot of other things that they're quite sure about, but don't necessarily own within their not sure matrix. Tim Keller made this point, I think, borrowing it from Michael Polanyi. They're quite sure it is wrong to not endorse gay marriage. They're quite sure it's wrong to block women from serving in church offices like men. And these are discussions in our own Christian Reformed denomination. They're quite sure about their political ideas. They're quite sure about a whole number of things that, you know, might not be categorized under religion, but is very much categorized under politics. And again, you sort of know my idea that, you know, religion is about the always and politics is about the now. And so being not sure about a bunch of always things doesn't seem to boil down into being less sure about a bunch of now things. They're quite sure that the ways in which church uses social pressure, church discipline and stuff, and exclusion is wrong. And while they no longer agree with those old ways that small, often insular communities used to pressure and enforce their beliefs and behavioral norms, they seem quite sure that government should use their quite broader and more considerable powers to enforce their newer ideas and norms upon often those small insular communities. And they come out along, you know, a whole range of other, you know, there's whole ranges of communities that have awfully divergent beliefs, but somehow this kind of diversity cannot be tolerated because of other kinds of diversity. And so, again, not sure? Well, they seem quite sure about a lot. While the communities that they left projected their ideas that they were sure of, sort of within their own tiny little tribes, and they'd project it out beyond them, but they had no power to enforce them. If you'd leave the Christian Reformed Church, I was not too long ago sitting with some of my relatives, and they were talking about the fact that there was this family in the Christian Reformed Church that even in the early and mid-20th century was still doing quite a bit of enforcing their norms and beliefs within the Christian Reformed Church. A family had a daughter that was pregnant outside of wedlock, and and the family stopped attending their Christian Reformed church. And sure enough, the elders came by to check on him and find out why they had stopped availing themselves of the means of grace by the preaching and the taking of communion. And, you know, basically the elders were met at the door with the notion that, well, we joined the RCA, and boom, there were, you know, the RCA wasn't enforcing those things like the Christian Reformed church was. And so people in the Christian Reformed church would tisk about that and feel themselves, their own sectarian self-righteous pride about being the, you know, God's chosen people who are actually doing what was right, unlike their RCA cousins who are slip sliding away. But all of this was confined within little communities. There were no government enforcement mechanisms to keep people within the Christian Reformed church. And a lot of what Rhett and Link talk about are the kinds of communal norms and expectations that are indeed painful, but, you know, nobody's being physically tortured or arrested or, you know, losing financial aid or a whole variety of other government things because they have different ideas about all sorts of things that churches have for a very long time had ideas about. While the communities that they left projected their ideas that they were sure of far beyond their own tiny tribes without the capacity to enforce them, often making these communities look a little bit ridiculous or provincial in their new ideas, of which they don't admit they are not sure, are actually enforced upon those other communities quite universally, even to the point of a new colonialism, which would use the political, financial, and military might of their nations to impose them on far smaller nations, let's say in Africa. All, of course, in the name of beneficial justice. But this really isn't too dissimilar to what had been done centuries ago in new colonialism. I made a comment a couple of years ago to someone during the CRC Synod that in many ways some of the people on the left are never more colonial than when they're complaining about colonialism. They're just as colonial as Christian ancestors with the white man's burden, bringing all of their ideas to Africa to liberate them from the heart of darkness. Well, this is tough, tough business. Again, I think about Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. Harm and fairness run right to the front, and all the other moral taste buds take a back seat. A good many of these things they are not sure of are passed along with the justification of, we just can't know. And so while all the political things they're very sure of, and these things are now self-evident and obvious, and only the conservatives and the religiously recalcitrant are, you know, dragging their feet and avoiding them, all the theological stuff is, well, we just can't know. We can't know what happens after death. We can't know what God thinks or if there is a God and blah, 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 blah. So all of that stuff is relegated to that we can't be sure of. And all of the other stuff is sort of, well, this is what justice demands, so we'd better get on with it and spare no expense to get it done. Now, this is worth exploring because what they are really doing is saying, I don't know, while deep down they do have some certainties that they're basing their feelings on. Again, see the video I just made about Nathan Jacobs in their not sure mode. I mean, what they really are is sort of post-Enlightenment. And I don't mean that in terms of in step with the Enlightenment, but rather beyond the Enlightenment. And again, as Brett and Link, if you listen to them in their video, it's very much an intuitional process, much more than, even though at one point, after the little commercial break that they have in the video, Rhett has this long piece on logic and reason where he's sounding like an Enlightenment person, but he's very much not using these terms. He's using those terms as an Enlightenment person, but he's using them really in a post-Enlightenment way. And again, I thought about doing a deconstruction of that segment of the video because I found a lot of it quite ironic. When it comes to things they care about, they are more saying you, their rivals, don't know, without admitting that underlying, well, we really do know. It's obvious and it's certain what should happen. There are whole ranges of things that we don't know, like life after death scenarios, they would say. In all fairness, again, this is me, the knowledge of these things is more limited than our knowledge of a good many things that are, you know, sort of under our control that we can play around with and play out that really are subject to our wills and our abilities to colonize them. But the subjectivity of this not sure, which is so often repeated loudly, often slips into an asserted subjectivity and false humble brag humility. And again, that's really, I've been struggling to think of the language of what I intuitively sense and what I feel from listening to their videos. And theirs, as Rachel Held Evans and John Sook, also seems to turn into some sort of humble brag. And I have a variety of examples of this. Well, nobody knew when the real fall would happen of the housing market and of the housing bubble. And nobody can know this and nobody can know that. And I think, really? Before the Great Recession and the housing collapse of the late 2000s, people would say, well, we sort of know that there's a bubble, but no one can know when it will come to an end. This is actually false. And the movie The Big Short demonstrates that. And Talib Nassim, apparently, I haven't gotten to his books yet, but had written about that. A number of people knew and timed it fairly well, actually. And so when we say, well, nobody knows, well, that's actually not true. Some people knew. And so then how exactly is that language working when we're talking that way? This is we sort of know that there's a bubble, but no one can tell when it will come to an end. This is actually false. Some people did know, meaning they looked at the signs, acted with conviction upon their beliefs, and in fact got it right, often against the great pressure, as the movie The Big Short made clear. They did their homework, they formed a hypothesis, they took action upon their knowledge, and in fact were rewarded for their actions. They did know. And compare this to a lot of what Link says about not knowing. They knew. Now, I didn't know. Probably almost everyone listening to this video didn't know. Many of us knew that there was a bubble and it was going to collapse, but we didn't know and we didn't act on our convictions, and we just sort of were there in the mushy middle. So what do we mean by I wrote this late at night, so what do we mean by you can't know? They want to project with an idea like this that there is somehow a thing of public knowledge that is democratically and universally embraced. That, well, nobody knows when the housing bubble will collapse. Well, some people did know. Well, why didn't everyone know? Well, that's a function about human beings and knowledge, actually. And that's a pretty durable function that doesn't seem to be going away and doesn't seem to be able to be dismissed and dismissed and is probably a feature and not a bug of human beings and why we're so durable in this world. So what are we actually talking about? We're imagining that this knowledge is democratically and universally available and hence embraced with certainty by everyone. Now, when here, now think about what that might be true of and immediately say, oh, there's got to be lots of things that's true of. Yeah, there might be, but when you think about, and again, I've got Verveke running around in my head with his relevance realization, what exactly did you need to be paying attention to know in that the 2008 housing collapse was going to happen? The guy in The Big Short knew what to watch. Other people knew what to watch, and they acted on it with conviction and sacrifice, and again, were rewarded for it. Now, again, this knowledge that we imagine that no one can know, This knowledge is democratically and universally available and hence embraced with certainty. Now, in hearing this, this doesn't sound unbelievable to us. We all imagine this to be, but if we pause for a moment and ponder this, it might occur to us that perhaps this is something we perhaps should be less sure of. This is something that I say to them, I'm not sure of this, and I don't think you really know this either. And let me explain. This is a form of knowledge too, and subject to the same kinds of deconstruction that we're talking about previous to this section. In other words, let's do a little deconstructing of this everybody knows or nobody can know type ideas. Think about something that should be, that you might assume to be of this nature. Something democratically, publicly, and universally known. Everybody should know this. Well, like things fall to the ground. Yeah, there's some things like that, but airplanes don't fall to the ground. Feathers seem to float, on and on and on. Let's talk about the world being a sphere. And we're traveling around the sun. Well, everybody should know this. And even though one of the things I would often do when I'd be asked to go to classes and talk about Christianity, I would ask how many of those people in the nice university lecture room, how many of you people believe the world is round? About everyone. I'd say, how many of you can demonstrate it to me without availing yourself of a picture taken from space? Almost nobody in those classrooms could give me a fairly simple analysis of how to do it, even though those things are around. In fact, I only know those analyses because I used to homeschool my kids, and these are some of the kinds of things that homeschoolers know, because you actually have to rummage around in the foundation of where a lot of the beliefs and assumptions that we have lie. And then you begin to realize that there's all these flat earthers running around, and you say, huh. In fact, I remember, as I've told in previous videos, driving down the coastline of the Dominican Republic with my translator with me, who'd translate my Spanish into Creole. I very quickly learned that this school teacher believed that the earth was flat. And then I had to figure out, should I as a missionary correct this in him? Should I as someone who knows he teaches school correct this in him? And if I start this, how integral to his life is this particular element of knowledge, really? These aren't the easiest questions to answer, even though everyone should know and no one should know. As you go to a marriage counselor and they'll caution you back from always never, and maybe I will now too. So, doubt, skepticism, yeah, I can play this game too. You'll likely find another group that have had their doubts about nearly everything you can think of, and they don't act in accordance with it. In other words, flat earthers will get on airplanes just like the rest of us. Or they don't care about it. This is how people are with all sorts of knowledge. And when you sort of understand what René Descartes was trying to do with I Think Therefore I Am, I mean, this was in some ways the type of certainty he was looking for, and finding it surprisingly difficult. So perhaps we might think about a near universal observation. We might think about a near universal observation about human beings, that knowledge doesn't always track well with democratically or universally held information. People are really inconsistent about a whole lot of things. And even when they say, I believe this to be true, they don't act in accordance with it. Now, part of this is what John Sook was pointing to in his book, I think, searching for perhaps a better definition of what a faithful community might center itself around. But I'm not entirely sure that some of these old standards are necessarily as decrepit as we might imagine. In fact, they might function not so much in ways we think they function, but they're functioning in other ways. In other words, they're the kinds of ideas that we find useful, but don't really know how to wield, and in fact, some of these ideas might be wielding us. In the Rhett and Link question and answer session, they also note that this also varies in terms of what they imagine to be relevant. Okay, and this is my question about Fennell and whether or not the world is round. How relevant is what I believe was an error in his thinking that the world was flat? How relevant was that to our little task of him translating my probably not terribly relevant sermons to Haitian people from Spanish to Creole? And all kinds of relevancies in his world. If I had challenged him, he probably would have caved immediately, just in terms of status and employment, but probably would not have changed his mind or reshaped his life. This is some of the complexity about human beings and knowledge. Common in deconstructions are the assumptions that a variety of religious or theological beliefs are pushed aside into a category of can't know or no one knows. But that move is, of course, itself an assertion of knowledge. So now that we're having this COVID-19 virus thing going through, suddenly there's a very big epistemological experiment going on in our societies. Who do we believe? Do we believe the president? Do we believe the CDC? Do we believe a random English, not even a doctor, YouTuber who I'm following every day? Do we believe the CDC? Do I believe my friends and neighbors who have experience? Or do I believe maybe someone I have a personal relationship who has a medical decree and tells me things? Now, are my decisions about what to do with whether or not we cancel worship services relevant? Whole bunch of new relevancies sort of crash in when new situations arrive, actually. And so assumptions about relevance are just as much in this question about can't know or don't know. Their assertion that such beliefs are irrelevant to regular life is too an assertion of knowing and a categorization of knowledge. I see the work of Alvin Plantinga, and he's done a lot of work on this sort of thing, as to whether or not belief in God is properly basic. Just Google that, and you'll get references to books and such. And, you know, Alvin Plantinga is a proud son of the Christian Reformed Church. Instead of a book, instead of a church or a book telling you what you can and cannot know, there are a set of beliefs, mostly crowdsourced and intuitively subscribed to. And these are usually some of the things that govern people's deconstructions more than what they read in a book. And in fact, in a way, Rhett dealt with that rather adequately, because if you get in this game of, well, I find experts on this side, you're going to find experts on that side. And so part of this reason, we much more intuitively, based on whole ranges of signals, sort of find our worldview pieced together. I'll talk about that a little bit more later, and probably in subsequent videos. Instead of a church or a book telling you what you can and cannot know, there are a set of beliefs, mostly crowdsourced, intuitively subscribed to, and sometimes unconsciously subscribed to, that are governing this piece of knowledge that the not sure person isn't really owning up to in their humble brag sort of way. We see this today in the COVID-19 epidemic. There will be a huge diversity of expressions of this in a free society, and we're seeing them already. People will have lots of ideas as to why they will or won't get the virus and what they will or won't do about it, et cetera, et cetera. John Campbell, in fact, in his YouTube, talked about there have been an increased number of alcohol poisonings in Iran. Apparently, because this might be completely wrong, people somewhere heard that alcohol can kill the disease. And he made the point, well, alcohol on the surface of your skin might kill the disease, but drinking alcohol, especially in an Islamic society that tends to frown on alcohol consumption, I'm going to drink this disease away. Not having a beer or a vodka screwdriver will not cure the disease. That's not how alcohol and the virus are related. Remember, relevance realization. And the more I think about this virus, the more I touch my face. People have lots of ideas as to why they will or won't get the virus and what to do with it, etc., etc. Some people will act on bad or wrong information, at least according to the scientists or the experts or the doctor, or by virtue of their own actions, feel vindicated, while others will find themselves in serious trouble and have regrets. This is what it means to be human. You'll have to make decisions that will be consequential for you based on all of this menagerie of conflicting information and signals. Yet, you'll be subject to a whole variety of things you can't control. You might try really hard to avoid the virus and be, you know, killed by food poisoning in your isolation. This stuff happens all the time. Global warming is a similar topic. People are making up their minds because of all sorts of ideas and signals around them. That's how we as human beings do it. And again, the diversity of ideas is probably a feature and not a bug. You'll find, in fact, that you are swimming in such situations throughout your life involving marriage, money, relationships, parenthood, etc. Much of it will be deeply consequential to your life in ways you can't possibly control. And often not know, but yet, here we are making decisions and non-decisions about these things every day. Now, I'm going to pause here so I can take a drink. Not of alcohol, just water. Now, the title of their video had to do with hell. And for afterlife stuff, all these same things come into play. Now, let's get to hell and death and dying. You can't know, is really what they keep saying. But really what they're asserting is, I want to assert that the people who think they know are wrong, and my ideas, even which I say I hold loosely, I am asserting some knowledge over that by virtue of my actions and inactions. There will be a cost analysis that they do. I should have had a end quote there somewhere. That's what I get for staying up late, typing a little screed into Google Docs. So let me see if I can phrase that and make better sense of it. So what you'll hear Rhett and Linka say, we don't know whether or not there's afterlife or something like that, but they're really sort of suggesting that the other people can't know. And again, in some ways, that's analogous to the 2008 housing bubble. Now, it might be that everybody in 2006 and 2007 are watching some people that say, I know, and other people that say, I know, and a good number of the people are wrong, and there's no easy way to verify who's right and who's wrong until, in fact, after the event. And that's very much what a lot of us are facing. But you really can't say that nobody knows, because lots of people think they know. It might be that you don't know, but what they're really wanting to assert is that I don't think these other people know. Well, okay, that's fine to assert, but you don't know that either. They do think they know, but you don't know whether or not they're right. Or maybe you do. That's how we are as human beings. Now, there'll be a cost benefit analysis that they will do, and like an investor in 2004 or a health conscious person in 2020 will make their best bets based on what they think they know and they don't know. And this is in fact why when Rhett says, I'm not worried about hell because I don't believe in it. I mean, I've made very similar comments, not about hell, but about many things. You know, I don't worry about what Muslims believe is my afterlife destination because I don't share their worldview. I think Rhett is exactly right on that. But we ought to be a little bit careful about this whole business about knowledge, because sort of what happens is we throw those things up in the air and say, you can't know. Well, I don't think they know that you can't know either. In other words, I see your doubt, and I raise more doubt to your doubt. Does that make any sense? But there will be a righteous, but there will be a rightness and a wrongness about it. As with everything, some who think they know will be right and some will be wrong. And the consequences for knowing and acting will be done. In other words, there's sort of a movement that says, well, I don't know, and you can't know. And there's sort of an insinuation that there are no consequences for this move. That can't be known either. Maybe there are, and maybe there aren't. And so that ought to lead us to a little bit of pause. Because in a sense, what they're saying is, there are no consequences to this. And I'd say, you can't know that either, especially given the new posture that you've embraced. At least in terms of this, everybody knows this democratically universal knowledge that we're dealing with, that we imagine is the kind of knowing that human beings do. He makes a point about Pascal's wager, but doesn't really exhaust it, because Pascal also had a point about actions and probability. Pascal's wager lingers on because while it might not close the deal for everyone, it's also hard to dispel, which is why it hangs around. Because Pascal's wager, in a sense, says, okay, well, you might not know, and we do live with a high degree of uncertainty, but that doesn't mean we can't know, and there are consequences for knowing or not knowing and choosing and not choosing, just like there are consequences for where to put your money in 2008, and there are consequences for how to live your life in 2020. Just because you imagine that any of this religious talk is consequence-free, well, I doubt that. And I intend to make an argument that says, even within, as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, that which is under the sun, there are consequences to it. And this consequentialism, psychologically, is not unknown to them, because a lot of their deconstruction talk deals with the consequences of deciding what now they do and don't know and are no longer sure of. There are consequences, too, regarding psychological outcomes in this life, which are sort of glossed over, even while they're also parading and forefronting other aspects of it. There's a lot of talk about freedom of their being not sure. They don't have to feel the need to condemn gays or exclude them from this or that. You know, they can hug a gay without feeling icky. I mean, they talked about this in some of the other videos. Often in a humble brag sort of way, they congratulate themselves on their evolution and heroism, which might come at a social cost to their old community and those pressures, which are, again, really very true, but also come with a social status upgrade, because in our culture, a lot of the beautiful people in government power is aligned with this evolution. That's, in fact, how communities work, that you will be rewarded by some communities for some ideas and punished for others, and vice versa. And sort of the thing we do with respect to social status is we intuitively look around and we say, who is everybody looking at? What is everybody desiring? Rene Girard. And what are we all interested in? And that's how we move together as a community. This is how fashion works. It's how we as human beings work. And so they've made some decisions, and these decisions have had psychological outcomes. Today, it takes a lot of courage to stand against the tide on many issues than to deconstruct it in the popular crowd. People come up on stage, and it takes a lot more courage to stand against the community in which you are living in. Now, here's the thing. Many of us are living in multiple communities at the same time, and so we're either nuancing or picking and choosing, and real courage tends to be things that you will pay a price for. And when I hear at the end of their question and answer video that they just released, when I hear them talking about having, you know, feeling relief that they finally did this, that's a very important statement, and it's a very true statement, it's a very real statement, it's a very right statement, but it's also a very psychological statement, because they likely had a sense of duplicity. Now when they go back home to Northern Carolina and even visit the church, and you know, they'll pay some of the social price, but now they're receiving, I'm sure, a lot of acclaim and applause by other groups of people. That's how we work, and it's inevitable, especially when we're living in the midst of complex communities full of differing opinions. That's just how we are. Sociology of knowledge is a real and powerful thing. For this reason, I'm not skeptical and dismissive both about the cost of deconstructing away from their Christian beliefs and their church communities. That took a toll. It's a reason their wives cried. That's very real stuff. But at the same time, they're now celebrated by another community. So for this reason, I'm not skeptical and dismissive both about the cost of deconstructing away from beliefs from one community or of origin, but neither am I terribly moved by the heroism of reconstructing into a belief that is celebrated by the beautiful, high status and powerful communities of their new setting. It sounds dismissive, but there's an element of truth to what they were doing even before they changed their zip code. I feel these same influences in terms of making new higher status friends. These are powerful, powerful things, as every parent of a teenager knows. It's just as we get older, we tend to get a little bit more sophisticated, but these same pressures remain. They don't feel the need to reinforce the social norms of their small community, but that feels like a weight off their social shoulders. But there always seems to be a moral or political or religious outgroup, and their new in-group will reward or punish their behaviors in terms of the new norms that must be upheld and reinforced. In other words, It's the new them. But it's the new them of the now. And how well will the new now, the new them of the now really endure in terms of as they travel into the future? This is where we sort of get into the Jordan Peterson Darwinian mode of trying to figure out wisdom. Here's the thing about the past. It's durable. As, you know, I talked to Tom Holland, it changes too. Oh, yeah. It changes too because we see the past through our own eyes and through our own filters. But that which survived from the past at least has that going for it. There is a Darwinian time factor involved here too. The old norms of their old subgroups may have become obsolete or at least felt obsolete. But in many cases, these norms have been time and community tested in ways that the new norms aren't. And I still have to find that clip of Jordan Peterson. I think it was with Sam Harris when Jordan Peterson was basically making the comment, and he made it so well that, yeah, to change, change is tough because a lot of changes are bad. To not change, yeah, not change is tough because often you have to change. There you are in the middle. It's really hard. And what you really want to have is relevance realization to figure out, well, which way is actually an upgrade? Well, and this is where what has endured, I can't remember this saying that I often use. Ontology is its own justification. Something that is for a reason. And this new thing that you've brought out, it is now, but we're making claims to its democratically accessibility or universally known and agreed upon. Your idea is going to have to weather a whole lot of storms and a whole lot of time before I buy that argument. So they don't know how the new norms will hold up or how new things will feel as time goes on. And again, Ross Douthat's, some of the when he's talking about sclerosis and a bunch of things in his new book, talks about this, that, you know, we're if you live in the now, you live in a very small place. And you live in a very fragile place because the now is always evaporating and it's always becoming into the future. And a lot of the things that you're holding on to will not endure. Well, how do I know that? That's what we've seen in the past. That's in many ways some of the best way we can have to judge the now and the future. This plays out in politics all the time. One person says that they're on the right side of history. Okay. But history is a large and complex thing. In the 1920s, to be on the right side of history for many people meant pro-prohibition for the sake of women and children. Just read history, folks. Pro-prohibition and pro-eugenics. See the history of Planned Parenthood. By the 1950s, the right side of history had changed dramatically. I hawk this book often, but I read it before I started doing videos. Read Oneida, A Free Love Utopia and a Well-Set Table. It's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderful book for now when you read the fact that at the end of the 19th century in upstate New York, that burned over district, you had a free love, egalitarian, utopian commune that was flourishing. Why is it no longer there? Why did they all become capitalists by the 1950s, known by their wonderful silverware that they made, the Oneida brand that you can still find and is respected? You find this Oneida brand silverware, and it's like, this is from a free love utopia? Yeah, that's where it started. And when you read what they thought of what they were practicing and trying, well, it was a brave new world. It had eugenics. It had equality between the sexes. It had non-monogamy. It had so many of the ideas that people tried out to say, oh, this is a wonderful new idea. Well, I hate to sound like the Book of Ecclesiastes, or maybe I don't really hate to sound like the Book of Ecclesiastes, but there's nothing new under the sun, so just read more. Many old groups bear the systems of old declining groups, and they don't know what declines their new groups will face. So enjoy the heyday of your new evolution and your new deconstruction, because it probably won't last long. Because there's the way, it's the way of the world to change. And all that is new will become old. And again, reviewing Jordan Peterson's rather long view Darwinian perspective on religious beliefs in the Bible. There's a reason this stuff endures. Now, there's lots of other stuff that endures that I don't necessarily agree with. But is it significant how long it endures, how well it endures, where it endures? Yeah, it actually is. What may feel so broad, open, and informed today, like all the decisions of the Oneida community, might look like yesterday's fundamentalism tomorrow. It does pay to do your homework. Instead of just saying nobody knows, which is not a humble statement, you might say, it's hard to be certain, but I will have to give it my best shot and face the consequences. That's really a more honest statement. Often I write stuff and it's inscrutable to me the next day. It seemed so brilliant when I was typing it in the moment. It is an assertion that the things left behind as non-essential, are actually non-essential. You don't know that. How do you know what is essential? You know? But the non-essentialism is, of course, subject to the knowledge problem that I've been talking about. How do you know what is essential and what is not? Again, get back to the Verveke stuff. This is a lot of the stuff that he covers. Now, again, John and I disagree with a whole lot, but a lot of his treatment of this, I think, is dead on right. What do we mean by essential? What do we mean by relevance? Well, you can't know. In other words, how can you know? A lot of what we're doing, I would call just dead reckoning. Oh, this is better than that. Well, these internal combustion engines seem better than horse manure. And we find all the ways that they're better. But again, one of my favorite pieces out of one of Jordan Peterson's classes is, what is a car? What is essential to a car? You thought it was a conveyance to get you from A to B, but it's a machine that rejiggers the chemical composition of the atmosphere and redefines cityscapes and changes how people relate to each other. What is the birth control pill? We don't know what these things are because we don't know their relevance because we're seeing in this tiny form. And so all these items about knowledge and non-knowledge, well, they're all subject to these ideas too. The internal combustion engine resolved the not inconsiderable problem of horse manure in urban areas. But did they know the consequences? Do they know what was essential about automobiles? We drive in the fog at great speeds. There is also the psychological feeling of well-being aspect to this. This is Sam Harris's well-being. Let's imagine that Sam Harris and his tribe are right about the idea that there is no afterlife. Let's imagine some person in some obscure religious group imagined that their tiny religious faction got everything right, and this person died in the full comfort and pleasure of being sure that their tiny group was right and will be thoroughly rewarded in a rich afterlife to the degree that they lived their days in generosity and anticipation of this eternity ahead. It's not hard to imagine. All good deeds will be rewarded and all wrongs punished, and all the wrongs of history perfectly compensated for by the best possible outcome that only an omniscient, all-wise, all-powerful being could achieve. Way better than the four of the good place. Let's compare that well-being to someone who doesn't know and just sort of hopes that either there will be nothing or something. Read Steve Jobs' biography. I forget that it was one out. It was a big one that came out. I can't remember the author right now. But toward the end of Steve Jobs just knew that, well, when he got pancreatic cancer, well, he didn't want any surgeon cutting him open. That's dangerous. He was just going to eat healthy, and that was going to take care of the pancreatic cancer. Well, he had a treatable form of pancreatic cancer, and guess what? He waited too long and lost his window. So then at the end of his life, then he starts postulating, is there more? Well, there they talked about it. Not sure. Psychologically, which well-being is better founded? The person of the small religious group that believes themselves so sure of everything that they die lovingly surrounded on their bed with the firm hope that a wonderful future awaits them? Or the people that say, eh, I hope so. In other words, in fact, a lot of people are saying, well, I'm just sure there's nothing. Oh, okay. Is that an upgrade from being sure of heaven? Let's compare that well-being to someone who doesn't know and just sort of hopes that either there will be nothing or something. They don't know. Let's apply Pascal's wager to this. It would seem to me that the person in the tiny religious sect enjoys greater well-being than the person who sort of hopes things will be okay. From this perspective, the newfound not sure person have brought themselves, all they've brought themselves is a degree of discomfort, a lack of well-being. Was this an upgrade? Now again, some of the things are going to feel like an upgrade, some of the things won't. That's the dead reckoning that we tend to do with respect to well-being all the time. All of the questions of knowledge and responsibility remain that you have for COVID-19 virus or the stock market or a housing bubble. Perhaps it is compensated for by the pride and happiness afforded by a status upgrade of joining people who are cool and beautiful in the culture. Guilty about it. And in fact, they gain moral status by expressing their feelings of guilt, which again, I as a Calvinist am enormously familiar with. I've seen Calvinists play this game forever. We're totally depraved, but I know it and declare it. Congratulations. Given the fact that most people of color tend to be more conservative and more religious than the white elites. But now I'm just being a little bit cheeky. What they really have is an implicit vision of the good life. And if you get right before the commercial break in that video, that's exactly what Rhett says. It's just our job to make things a little bit better for the next generation. Ah! Better involves relevance, realization, and knowledge, and it's that also is constructed by your worldview. Now, a lot of things are sort of dead reckoning A-B tested along the way, but they're not really known. Is it better to get COVID-19 now in a light strain rather than perhaps some other mutation which coming down the road? You don't know. Is it better to cancel things now and face probably a recession or to just muscle through in the hopes that this whole thing won't be as serious? You don't know, or maybe you do. You can't say that no one can know. Some people are probably right. You might not. Well, what does that mean you're left with? Well, you're left with the Jordan Peterson moment of having to act. What they really have is an implicit vision of the good life, which is not really subject to their own not sure at all. They're pretty sure about the good life. In fact, they opt for it. They've also got not sureness about the good life, and they're wrestling with those things. But by virtue of their decisions and their actions, they are making decisions, and they have, as Jordan Peterson said at Lafayette College, they have a religion back there in the back of their head. That vision has been constructed pre-volitionally, communally. They can't disagree with me that it's the product of the sociology of knowledge operation, or maybe it's just been implanted by God or the gods. But we do know that if we want to shape our beliefs, we exert some agency not over the rider, but over the path the elephant will take. This is what religious communities have been doing, actually, right from the beginning. So again, in their video, and this was actually the first slide of a video I was going to make, it might be the first slide of a subsequent video, hell, fear, morality, and beliefs. Your beliefs are pre-volitional. Your beliefs are pre-volitional. You don't choose them. They appear self-evident. That's what they do. They appear self-evident to you, not to whoever else you're talking to. They are not publicly self-evident. They are formed historically. That's what my belief system says. They've formed historically out of personal history, out of the communal cultural history, and also out of things that we don't know what. And now you might say God, which really isn't a bad word for exactly what we're talking about here. And in many ways, that's pretty much Jordan Peterson's argument with Sam Harris when they talked. But now back to Jonathan Haidt, who in many ways launched this whole video thing. That's how that's how Warren Mills, my friend Warren, found Jordan Peterson. And in many ways, if I hadn't first found Jonathan Haidt, I probably wouldn't have been interested in Jordan Peterson. Reading Jonathan Haidt books for a number of years, The Rider, The Elephant, and The Path. Religious communities have long known that your agency over your pre-volitional beliefs are partially subject to your volition by exercising agency over the path. So you get some say in what you believe. You don't get to choose your beliefs, you just sort of believe them. But you do get some say in how the beliefs are formed. And actually, when you think about it, that's a pretty good mix. But it's not as direct as our current agency regimes like to imagine. So there's the elephant metaphor. The rider is the rational mind, the elephant is the emotional mind or the intuitive mind, and the path are environmental factors. Here's what the rider gets to do. I had a time difference in the conference call. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up. So that's what the rider does. Another resource to think about, Why I Left and Why I Stayed. Tony Campolo talking to his son, Bart, who had quite a large departure from Christianity. It's a heartfelt video, and I'll put the link to it. And the book is also excellent. But one of Tony's big points was, Bart, you left the church. And when you left the church, I pretty much knew now you were leaving the faith. Now, is it a chicken and egg thing? Yeah, that's certainly true. But the point is, it's the path that in many ways will determine what you believe. Eric Dirksen made the same point in my conversation with him. He said, you know, it used to be in the past, if someone started sniffing around church, I'd want to get a book to read. In a sense, that's handing something to the writer. Now I say, start going to church. Because it's in the context of that community that these things are formed. And now John Sook, of course, continues to go to church, but there's the kind of church, which is, again, why I'm quite interested in his path. And so in many ways, I look at things from both sides now, and you can sing that old song. Agency and belief are not linear. We are rightly responsible for our beliefs and actions and face the consequences for them. We face rewards and punishments for them. In this world, not always justly. But like the COVID-19 or climate or finance, we will face consequences, reward or judgment in this life and beyond. Just a little nod to Jordan Peterson. And one of the meetups, someone says, he gave people ego. And I've been thinking about that. And some people challenge that. I don't think ego is the right word. What he did was give people agency. He encouraged them to think, to research, to decide, to risk, to live. And I think that actually addresses some of what Ross Douthat is dealing with in terms of our agency. And so, again, that's part of the reason why I'm not hugely bothered by Rhett and Link's deconstruction, nor John Sook's, nor Rachel Held Evans, even though I disagree with them. At least they're showing some agency here. At least they're engaging in the conversation. And I think, as Tim Keller said, you need some doubt in order to, and you might even need to do some deconstruction in order to actually reconstruct something that is deeper, broader, firmer, better to get beyond our decadence. Well, I'm out of time. I gotta run. Thanks for listening.